Now, can you tell me how many livery stables were in the town?
One.
Jack McGowan
is right here.
That thing on?
Jack McGowan had one down where Art Collier is now. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether that's the same barn or not, I can't tell you. But he had one there, and he was one of them hoss men along with them. But I think them was the only two. There was a Charlie Sleeper used to have one or two old horses he lended, but his wasn't really one. They used it themselves, and he was bored in there while they'd rent your horse. Mm.
And the other one was Orchid.
Orchid.
M. Orchid.
M. Orchid was right here where we are now.
Where
Fred is in. That
yeah,
is here. That's the Orchid place.
Where Fred Fred Orchid lives now.
Yeah.
Now, could you describe what a livery stable looked like?
Well, it was just a common big barn, just like it's down to Jimmy's there. Now.
Jimmy.
Collier.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I see. Yeah.
And it was a bit, and that was Jack McGowan's livery stable mm-hmm. right there. And Jack never had as many horses as the other one, see, as old M. M used to keep, he had quite a few horses, because he used to lend a lot of them out, or hire them out, as we'd call it. But Jack always had them. Then he quit the livery stable before M did. And he have got him an old Ford car. That was what he done for a living.
Mm-hmm. Well, the horses were down on the first floor.
Oh, yeah. Had to be on the floor.
And then they had the...
Had a stall for each horse. Uh-huh. And the cribs run across this way.
Uh-huh.
And this horse had his feed in there, and every one of them. And when you fed that horse, you have to go in... Now, like if this was a stable, you had your hay out here, and you shoveled it right through the window, so much for each horse. And
the hay was outdoor?
No, kept it in the barn, and they used to have hay hauled in, and it wasn't pressed enough, uh-huh. most of it. On the earlier days, it wasn't pressed, they'd lug it in the barn, not it. And then you'd push that much hay through there. But for the oats, you would give them a quart a day or so on like that. You'd go inside of the horse and put it in another little box within the corner here. This would be the oat box right here.
They kept the hay on the second story up in the
yeah.
barn? Yeah.
And you'd shovel down so much each day. When you get ready, we say, for you're going to feed them breakfast, you shovel down so much hay for the breakfast, and then when it come noon, you've done the same thing and suffer the same thing. But see, they always bought this hay in a big load, and then they hauled it up in the top story there,
uh-huh.
in the top barn. I don't know if there's a barn round here now that's got one of them windows in.
Yeah, great big
square door.
Yeah,
and you shovel the hay, this is the first thing, you shovel the hay in there, and maybe you'd be shoveling in here, and then I'd be back in that, dragging it back further. We'd get
mm-hmm.
the barn full, and then that's what they'd use, and they'd have to buy, if they run out, they'd have to buy it from a farmer, and he'd have to come back and do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, did they have quarters outdoor? Did they have a pasture?
Oh, yeah, they had a place that takes the term, well, I'll give you an illustration. You know this one over to the Great Northern Barn there,
uh-huh.
the fence way out around?
Yeah.
Well, when they wasn't working them in the summer there, why, they'd let them run out around there, more or less.
Uh-huh.
But mostly the stable horse, they kept them in quite a lot. But I mean, if they had one that wasn't too many or something, if they would win there. And that, but them that's outside there were supposed to get some feed out of the stable, but they'd eat a lot of grass and stuff.
Now, they didn't have workhorses
there. No, for this livery stable, they had a small horse. Some would be pretty good size, you know, but not big workhorses.
Mm.
Most all small horses.
Now, did they rent wagons and...
Oh, that wagon and the horse all went together.
Oh, I see.
They didn't seem to be not much saddle job then, because all, well, you wanted to sit down and be comfortable when you were riding if you went. They rented horses, I don't know how, they'd go to Presque Isle with them,
mm-hmm.
and they'd go to Portage Lake with them.
How much would they rent a horse for, horse and wagon?
Horse and wagon from here to Portage, I think, from here to Sheridan, Maine, used to be 75 cents if we was going to a dance.
Mm-hmm.
And if you stayed a little longer, why, he'd time you anyway. You might have to pay another 25 if you come back late in the morning.
Now, did the doctors use a livery stable a lot, or did they have their own horses?
No, they had their own horses. Now, like this place over here, Killion's. See, they kept their horses right in there, and the doctor also had a man to take care of his horse and drive it. Just like Dr. Nolan down here, mm-hmm. See. He had the patient and I take care of the horse and everything.
At the livery stable?
No, his own house.
His own house.
Oh, yeah, that house down there now, that same barn. Mm-hmm. Well, I think he had two horses at that time. Mm-hmm. And whoever was driving for him used to do that. And, of course, he wouldn't go alone in the winter because he'd have to have somebody with him if he got stuck, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times the doctor go from here to, we'll say the Oxbow. Well, if it was a windy night, a lot of times you'd have to get out and push it, you know, have hard work to haul through a big drift or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how he paid this man. He paid him so much a day or so much a week. And that was him. Now, there was different fellows would have different jobs. And a lot of times in the late years, a fellow like, Eau Claire, one of the Eau Claire boys, he could call him any time in the night that you called him. If you called the doctor, why, he'd call the Eau Claire boy, and Bill used to do a lot for him, and he'd have to drive the doctor, see, because the doctor didn't dare to go up that for 20 miles alone. You just think of a doctor driving 20 miles up to see a person, and of course he had to go them times.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor didn't tell you now, you bring him or you do this.
Yeah, he had to go.
He had to go. That was more of a less of a, we'll say, an unwritten law.
Now, did they have a certain amount of men that worked at the livery stable,
Well, they never had, most generally one. Once in a while, M was the biggest livery stable around here, because his stable was wide enough, they had horses. Oh, I suppose M would have 8 or 10, maybe 8 horses. And there was so much on this side and so much on that side. If you wanted to see something that's about the same, you go over here to the Realty Barn now and look into it, and you could see that just the way it is. There's so many horses on this side and so many horses, but that is a lot bigger than a livery stable would have been in them days.
Did they have a man that stayed there all the time with the horses?
Oh yeah. Now, over the one that took care of the horses, Pearly Collins was the fellow who took care of them over there for a while, and that place is out on that side, on the right-hand side, as you went to Northern Barn. That's an office there, and you have a place to sleep and a place to cook. That man stayed there. Now, like Pearly Collins done that for a long time. He used to stay there and do his own cooking and everything. Of course, she'd bring him over, his wife would bring him over bread and stuff like that, but like the meat or whatever he was going to cook, he'd done that himself.
So that there was always a man at the livery stable, day or night, whether you wanted a horse.
Now, like the big livery stable over to M's over here, he had a man there all the time. And most generally, they might shift off. M would take a forenoon or something himself, or one of the boys or something. That's the way they used to do it. But they had one man, supposed to be that one fellow about all the time. Because they didn't keep it locked hardly in there. The fellow was sleeping there, you could just walk in, wake him up, and hire your horse and buggy, and away you go. And they had another thing there, too. He used to have a couple of rubber-tired wagons. Well, if you wanted to pay a little more, you could ride in a rubber-tired wagon.
What is that?
The wheels were rubber, like
your
car, but
there
was a different rubber. There was a hard rubber. But that was a nice fancy rig. If you wanted to go take your girl out, why, of course, you hired one, cost you another dollar.
Was it easier riding?
Oh, yes, much easier riding. It was a tire just like we got on our bicycle, something like that.
I see.
And Joe, I think him had one or two of them, but you paid more money if you wanted to take your girl out. It'd be just going out to have a night's fun and a few drinks of liquor while you didn't care whether there's any wheels on it or not.
Now, let's switch over to the blacksmith shop. Did they have more than one in Ashland here?
Oh, yes. One time there was, I think we had two here one time, and then we had down to Sheridan would be another one. See, but that wouldn't be for your hire. That is the Ashland Mill Company had one or two blacksmiths all the time.
Yeah.
But at that time, you've done a lot of your mill work with your blacksmith.
Yeah, I see. Who owned the blacksmith shops here in town? Can you remember?
In town?
Yeah.
Charlie Stewart had one, and I can't remember. There's a fella years before had one right down here where your town office is now.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Hopper, his name was.
Oh,
old Bill Hopper. And he didn't care whether you could blacksmith or not as long as you could play cribbage. But he used to have two blacksmiths, Bill Hopper did.
Two.
At that time, yeah. He had two blacksmiths.
Working in the shop.
Working in the shop. And then he had a woodworker too, because they used to make sleds at that time. He had two blacksmiths in there. I can remember, I was pretty young at that time when they had that. And them men worked there. That's where Charlie Stewart used to blacksmith before he went into his own blacksmith shop.
Now, they must have had quarters to keep the horses there at the blacksmith shop.
Oh no, you owned the horse repair horses. You took them in to get them shod, and they had a big building there where you could shoe them.
But they did it right off? I mean, they wouldn't have any waiting period or
no,
anything?
No, hardly ever. Now, like, if you had a pair of horses and you wanted them shod tomorrow, you'd tell the blacksmith, I'll be in tomorrow. But sometimes they'd be, now, Hopper, I've seen him with three blacksmiths in the shop down here. And, of course, they was always doing something to get the time in, but if they wasn't all shoeing horses all the time, why, they was making, we'll say, bobsleds, tote sleds, and all that stuff. They made all that stuff in the blacksmith shop that time.
Yeah. How many men did it take to shoe a horse?
One.
Just one?
Yeah. And one fella could shoe a horse. See, he tied him up here to the place there. They had a place. And if he was a bad horse, they used to tie him. You know, so he couldn't... Some of them horses would kick him. But Henry Garman was the greatest blacksmith.
Well, what'd you do if he had a stubborn horse that didn't want to be...
Oh, well, Henry Garman was the fellow I was going to tell you about. He'd run right up and take that horse right in the ribs with a hammer or something. The first thing he'd scare him, put him near death, and then he'd grab his feet and start shoeing. He didn't have to, a lot of people used to have to tie the horse, you know, so they couldn't get at him.
Put him in a sling kind
of?
Yeah,
kind of a sling. And they used to do that, and they have been known to throw them and shoe 1 foot at a time. See? That's all they shoe anyways, 1 foot at a time. But most horses were kind. But once in a while, there used to be horses around here, but nobody would shoe them, only Henry Dahmer. He had a knack of doing that while the other ones didn't. And of course, that is the big workhorse. Now, when you come down to the horse like the trotting horse, he wasn't so bad because a big, heavy man could put near wrestle him anyway. And that was more of an educated thing, the man was shoeing that trotting horse. And there was a difference between your trotting horse and your pacer. They had little different shoes. And all those shoes had to be weighed. They weighed them before they nailed them on. And now, for some way, Charlie Stewart told me that was to take them, they had to maybe make the shoe a little different on the pacer. If you didn't, could throw him off.
Mm-hmm. And it was a different type of shoe again.
Oh yeah, the pacer was a different shoe, and the trotting horse was another one. See, the pacer went this way, and the trotting horse went that way.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie had told me about it. Of course, I never blacksmithed, and I don't know anything about it.
Well, they made their horseshoes right there.
Oh, they made them right there.
Ahead of time, or as the horse.
Well, they could make them as they go along, but then in the later days, come they used to buy the shoes
mm-hmm.
as the time shifted, same as they do now. They used to buy that shoe. They'd buy one size for the trotting horse and another one for the working horse, but they used to be a little different size. Some horses, like the person, they had a bigger foot than the other one. So, but they was made around like this so the blacksmith could bring them in, heat them and bring them in and bend them over and put the toe cork on on them. See, they used to bend one down like this on this end, and up on the other end, they'd put the cork on right in front. The shoe would come with nothing on it.
Mm-hmm.
Then they'd make it the rest of the way themselves. The shoe would come round like this, And then they turned this down to make a cart, and then this one up here, they had one about that long, and they'd heat it and weld it right into the other one.
About 3 inches long?
The tow cart in front would be about, 2.5 to 3 inches, pardon the size of the horse's foot. And the back one was just like, this was the back of the shoe, they just tipped this much down to make a cart. And they'd sharpen that cart right up, so it would stick in on the ice or anything else. And then in the summer, they used to put just a flat one on. See, because they didn't care, unless they went to him putting him in a pulling job or something like that. But most of them, the summer around on the farms, just wore flat ones. But in the woods, they mostly had corks on them because he was on roots and all this stuff, and so he wouldn't slip off. But on the farm, as I remember, most of them in the summer were shod with just a flat shoe. And the last of it, them shoes come factory made. Mm-hmm. And but in the early days, the blacksmith made them himself. Found him right out.
Now, is that all they did at the blacksmith shop? I mean, they shot a horse and they made sleds.
They made sleds, and they picked anything. Like if you had a peavey you wanted fixed, mm-hmm. why they'd fix that peavey and sharpen the dog in it and sharpen the picks and all that. They done anything that was worked by iron, that blacksmith done it. And like if you come there with a broken sled, and had to have another shoe put on it. You come now with a wagon, he'd have to heat. There's something, that tire or something was wore out or something, he'd have to make that tire over and heat it and shrink it on there. They done all kinds of work that blacksmith did. He made tote sleds, he made wagons. Now the Getchell people in over in Fort Fairfield used to be the great wagon makers. That was their business, not just blacksmith. But they went right into the business of making these Getchell wagons. They made a high wagon and they made a low wagon.
How much did it cost to shoe a horse?
Well, in the early days, I can't remember. But I think the last of it, as I remember it in later years, that sometimes it's $15.
To shoe a horse?
Put four shoes on. See, you had to buy the shoes. Then you had to work on them, and they charged you. I think the last I remember was $15 for shoeing a horse.
What if you just had put one shoe on? What if he lost?
Oh, well, if he lost a shoe or something, I don't remember what that price would be, but it would be according to the high price.
I see.
But they used to lose pull a shoe off, and most there was a lot of people. If you was a fellow driving a logging team, you could put the shoe back on if you lost a shoe and you had another one to fit him. You always kept that stuff around the lumber camp. And most generally, if you was a teamster, you could put a shoe on. If you couldn't, there'd be somebody in that logging camp that could put one on. In some logging camps, when they were big enough, they had a blacksmith. Because, well, you see, that paid off because he fixed all the sleds, fixed all the broken whiffle trees, and anything like that, see?
What's a whiffle tree?
Well, it's about that long, and it's brown, and it's got a place here on this end. That's why you have a trace chain. I don't know whether you ever heard of them or not.
About 2 feet long?
Oh, yes, it's longer than that, 3 feet. Mm-hmm. Then this trace chain went up to here, and you hooked that on the tug on the horse's harness. Had something like that, and you just come from your whiffle tree here, and went from there up onto the, you hooked that on the tug. When you come in at night, you just unhooked them four and left your crotch chain right here.
There was a right angle.
Yeah, you had a crotch chain about this long, then you hooked the whiffle trees up here on it. That whiffle tree was about the length of this here, and then there was a ring in here and a hook in it, so you could hook it in your crotch chain.
What'd they use those for?
Hauling logs, and you're just saying when you hooked up in a wagon, you had the whiffle tree, or you had
what's
another.
The difference between a whiffle tree and a twitch?
A twitch is just something you're twitching. You mean when you're twitching anything? A log?
Oh, I see. That's a term for just pulling on.
Yeah, that twitching is like you hook onto a log here with a crotch chain. You have the crotch chain and whiffle trees right with you. You just back up and put a chain, or the crotch chain here has got a crotch hook. You put the chain on and hook it right into just a hook there. And then you try to haul it out to the yard or something like that, and you just unhook it and drive off, and the other fellas on the yard, maybe you have to take them up with a block And if it's downhill like this, if it's downhill, well, your yard is here, she's coming down. He rolls out of the man, yard tender, we call him. Mm-hmm. He rolls them down himself.
Oh, I see. Well, while we're talking about horses, let's talk about the racetrack that they used to have up here. Can you remember when that got started?
Oh, yeah, I remember it well. Alf Trafton, that would be Kit's father. He was, I think he owned the most in it. As a matter of fact, they maybe put it near all. And he was a great fella for racing horses.
He was the one then built the, had quite a bit to do with it?
I think Alf was the man that was the instigation of building that track up there. Of course, there was a lot more men had money in it. But Alf was seemed to be the, we'll call him the foreman. Mm-hmm. He was looking after it and looking after money and a bit and all that stuff.
Do you know what year this was? Right offhand?
No, I don't. But that was way back early in the early years. I was only maybe...
18, in the 1800s?
Well, I would be maybe 15, 20 years, maybe 18, 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I went from the... used to go see them horses. They used to race them on the ice, too, down here, you know. That used to be a great thing.
On the ice?
Yeah.
Sulky racing on the ice?
Yeah. They used sulkies and little sleds. A little pung, we called it.
Mm-hmm.
But the last of it seemed to be that they thought they'd do better with that sulky, with the rubber tires on it.
Mm-hmm.
But they used to use them both, and they used to use a race right on this river here.
On the river?
Yeah. I mean, right after it froze all up, see?
Sure.
You get down there when they had a couple of feet of ice or more, they'd race them horses. And of course, at that time, going back to blacksmithing again, they had to have them shoes good and shot. See, so that horse wouldn't slip.
Yeah. I would think they'd have to have them pretty sharp. Was it true that we had one of the best tracks in the state of Maine up here?
Well, I don't know as we'd say, but we had one of the good ones, we'll put it that way. Because they done a lot of racing up here at one time. And that would be maybe when I was 25 years old or something like that. But that time they had a nice track up here.
Was it a mile around it?
That's what they called it, a mile. I don't know, but that's what they called it. And they had a nice grandstand up there. I mean, outdoor grandstand. And you paid so much to get in that seat.
Mm-hmm.
You mean there was just same as any grandstand.
Did they have stables and everything?
They did have stables up there. But, and they had stables in other places. They had stables too. You know, a horse racing more than they did here was in Presque Isle. That was a big outfit, but this was small, but they had stables up here.
Mm-hmm.
And they had grandstands, and they had all that stuff that would go with anything.
Now, how often did they race? Did they race once a week or once a month?
Well, they used to, most generally, if I remember right, after when they got to working here, it would be more of like a carnival. That was that when the kid got killed, that was a carnival.
Mm-hmm.
And when they get down, then they put them down on the river, and they used to scrape that right down to the bare ice, which would be 2 feet, and they had a certain length of way there, so much running, and you most generally done 2 heats. That would be go down, and then come back up. But they keep going all the time, but... The head horse, Fred House had one of the good horses that used to race on the ice here. And I think there was a lot of difference. Of course, they were just good on the ground, but some horses seemed to be raced better on the ice than the other one.
But they didn't race regular, I mean, like once a week or...
No, it would be sometime, like we used to have now, like we had something different here. You know, if you had a holiday, they'd use that, and they'd use the other one, whatever they done.
Were there different classes of horses, like 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds, or did they all race together?
Well, they didn't seem to sort that out. If you had a young horse and you thought he was awful good, you'd slam right in with the rest of them.
I see.
Yeah, but they didn't put them out, single them out, same as they do now. See, you have your... Your young horse, the next one to him, 3-year-old, 2-year-old,
yeah.
And 4-year-olds from there on, whatever they want to do.
Was it only the local people from town that raced, or were they
Oh, if there was a fellow in Presque Isle wanted to bring his horse over here and race him, or if we wanted to take one over Presque Isle and race him, which was all the same, you just entered him, and they called it entering them. And if you had a good horse, you'd take him over there. If they had a good one, they'd bring him over here.
Did they race for a purse or a trophy or anything?
Oh, yes, they'd have so much. They'd get up so much money some on, but it wouldn't be any too much more than maybe shoe them a couple of times.
I see.
Couldn't be more money to mount. And of course, when you get over to Presque Isle, well, there was a big grandstand and taking the same up here. They used to charge you to go into park, you know.
Yeah.
You had, that was wired all the way around. And that money went in to paying for one prize and the other prize all the way around. Just same. They done the same then as they do now, but of course the purse wasn't nothing like they are now.
Would it be common for an owner to have more than one horse?
Some of them would. Now, Alf only, he had 2-3, but his great horse was Queen Inus. And
this was all sulky racing, no horseback?
No, all sulky. Everything was a sulky. And they used to have John R. Braden was the great racer of all times up here. Him, John R. Braden and Queen Inus. They seemed to be collecting all the money. And John R. Braden is buried over here in Presque Isle in the park.
The horse?
Yeah, the horse is buried. Wouldn't I seen something about it here a while ago? And he, his grave is right there, and you can go look at it if you want to. And what that fellow used to drive him was a fellow named Willard. Huh?
Now what about, did they have street races here?
They did up to that time. They had, you mean in the street races for horses?
Yeah.
Yeah, well that's, and then after that boy got killed, they shifted and all that was down on the ice. They wouldn't let them race here no more.
I see. They used to have winter street racing.
They used to have winter street racing, like if you had a special day, like a holiday or something, where they'd always get something out and they'd have a race.
But then after the young boy was killed, they never
raced.
No,
they never raced in the street no more, but they used to race down on the ice.
Now let's switch over and you tell me about butchering a pig.
Well, back years ago, when we used to chicken in the neck, and you know, and I tell you, a fellow was awful good about it. What's his name down here? Ellis.
Wilford
Ellis. Well, he could seem to hit that big vein good.
And then you just. Then
he hit that big, they hold him and they stick the knife in there in that vein, then they let him go and bleed, and he'd bleed to death. Then later, they used to shoot him in the head with a .22.
Well, what was the best way?
Well, of course, everybody looked at it saying you or I would, it was too cruel to let him bleed to death. But if you knew how to hit him with a hammer, or a .22 rifle, you get above his eyes up here, right up here, and you take a little .22 and take him to the head, and he's dead. And then you stick him.
I see.
And let him breathe.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's they do that now. Huh? I didn't hear you. Well, I had used to take a pig to Fish Lake every year in my canoe, a little fella like this. And I'd raise him and feed him out of the sporting camp all winter. I was working that time for Dillon Sporting Camp. And when I'd bring him down, he'd run around 225, 250 sometimes. And I brought him down and I used to feed him with corn. Until I get ready to kill him about Christmas time. And I killed him this time and hung him up in the shed. I guess Dana West helped me hang him up. And then Bert Haggerty, an old friend of mine, he'd come out and his wife come out and Jimmy and Mildred Dunn come out, and I had this pig hanging up in my shed. And I didn't know it. They went out and when the party was all over, I went out and I didn't have no pig. For about 10 minutes afterwards, or 20 minutes or something, Jimmy Miller was still there, and Mr. Burke thought he'd be cute, and he called up and wanted to know if I knew where I could buy any pig. Anywhere around. And I said, yes, you can pay me for that on your stove. So, no cars around then, but Jerry Smead. Jerry Smead and his wife was there that night, too. So Jerry Smead had a car, and we went out the next day or two, and Bert said, you can come up and get the pig, he said. I said, you haul him out, you haul him back. So, and Jerry and his wife was living with us then, and we started to get up one morning early, Jane and I, that'd be Jerry's wife, and we were getting breakfast, and Laura and Jerry hadn't got up yet. We looked out the window, here comes Bert and Yuda. The singer was, wasn't it? Yeah, Bert and Yuda. And they had the pig. So I said to Jane, get inside there somewhere. I said, we locked the door. And had to hang that pig up. And that Bert from there killed himself getting that pig out of the car and lugging it in and hanging it up again. And when he got it all hung up, there was a block there and everything. He got it all hung up and tied up. And I said, Bert, now you got drunk last night, and I know you did. Now you come in and we'll pay you. We'll give you a drink of whiskey.
Bet he never stole another pig.
No, you ask him about it sometimes. Tickle him almost to death.
Now, did they use everything on a pig? Could you use everything?
Well, now that French people used to even use the blood to make the blood sausage, but I never did myself because I don't care about them. Mm-hmm. But they would use everything on that pig.
What about his tail?
That was used, and they used to use his ears and grind them up to make hogshead cheese. When you were making hogshead cheese, a lot of people put them ears in.
Put the ears in?
Yeah, that's why you clean that ear and scun it all off and everything and grind it right in with your hogshead cheese. That was in the old days back. I can remember. I don't know, but your mother done it.
What did they do with the tail?
Well, you fought over that. Whoever got that tail, he roasted that.
Roasted it?
Yeah, in the ashes.
I see.
Put him in there and let him cook when he was done. Then when you took him out, that skin came right off of that, and then you cleaned it all off and you ate it.
Not much meat there.
No, but they do you for lunch. But that was the best part of the pig.
The tail?
Yeah.
Now, let's go over and talk about a still. Did you ever own a still?
A sportsman brought me up the barrel and the pipes and everything, and I'd have learned before that to make it. We used to boil it down then in a boiler, a regular boiler, and turn the cover upside down, and the steam would come up, and that was your alcohol, and we'd let it fall back into another pan. But this one, the sportsman brought me a 5-gallon charred barrel. That's to make take everything out of the liquor. And we used to make it that way. And I remember one year I buried a barrel 5 gallons up to the camp over across the lake. You didn't want nobody to see it. And we come back in the spring, and I called a sportsman in one time to give him a drink. White Lightning, we used to call it. And he had a drink of it, and he wanted to know where we bought it. And I said, I didn't buy it. I said, we made it, and he couldn't believe it.
Now, what'd you make it out of?
Well, then, like you put the, we used to get molasses and sugar and let it, and put yeast cakes in it and let it, for only 7 or 8 days, let it boil up.
You put a fire under it and let it boil?
No, it was set right in that. That yeast cake and stuff made it work.
Oh, I see.
And like grease and rice bread. And when that would get all done, then it would all go down. And then we'd take and boil it down. We put it in there, rigging. First, we can just, about everybody had a big wash boiler. And you put that stuff in there, so much, about 6 or 8 inches of it in there. And then you turn the cover upside down and let it boil, and you had a pan hung under there, so you'd take this stuff. See, your boiler cover slanted like that, mm-hmm. And you had a machine made to hook onto that so you could set this pan in. And you'd boil that down, you'd have a pretty good sized pan in the middle. That was the old-fashioned way. But after the sportsman brought me my stuff, why, we didn't have to bother with that old boiler. We made it and come right out dripping in this pipe. We had it in a brook up Fish Lake, little brook. And this would drip out just, well, just fast as it could be. And we'd keep shifting it and putting it there. And we'd always boil it over twice. That made it a lot stronger.
Really curl your hair.
Oh yeah, curl your hair right up. Well, you couldn't drink it. You couldn't drink it half and half.
Did you ever make it out of anything else? Did you ever, the old way they used to talk about taking a pumpkin?
No, but we did used to put some potatoes in. But we'd, well, as old Walter Boyles told one time, he used to be an old fellow and made it too, and my first starting in, I asked him what he'd made when he put in the barrel. I said, what are you putting in the barrel, Walter? Well, Walter said, I'll tell you. He said, put anything that'll rot, and then you can boil it down. It'll be all right.
Well, I've heard of them making it out of pumpkins.
Well,
with sugar in the pumpkin.
You could. Anything, that's right, anything that'll formate and boil up. That'll boil sometimes. You had it set in the wrong place. Now, if you had it barrel in the camp, you could hear it working. You know, you'd think there was a mess of bees in there. And then after a while, it stops. When it stops fermenting, well, then it's all ready to, it's all ready to boil down then.
And this was hard liquor?
Oh, yes, it's a number of pure alcohol.
What about beer?
Oh, and,
Brew.
Oh, they used to make that. That was almost seemed to be legal back in the days when they didn't have no, was supposed to have no rum.
Lila, tell me about the time that your little fella had an incident with home brew.
Well, his father had some beer, and kid-like, he thought he wanted a taste, and he gave him about one little sip. And he ran with his little cup every time his father had the beer. So that was all right. We moved from here out to Portage, and of course at our church we had to go up the altar and take communion, and he knew that. But it was Communion Sunday in Congregational Church in Portage. And they passed communion right round through the congregation. And he looks up and he said, I don't want any bread, but I'll take a glass of beer. And I almost went through the floor.